Welcome to Counter Stories, a podcast by people of color, for people of color, and everyone else. My name is Anthony Galloway. I'm the executive director of Arts Us.
Luz Maria Frias, president and CEO of YWCA Minneapolis.
Don Eubanks, associate professor at Metropolitan State University and cultural consultant.
Hui Lee, owner of the Other Media Group.
And joining us, Ms. Marianne Combs from Minnesota Public Radio.
Thanks very much. Yes, happy to be here.
So we haven't been around in quite a while. Take a listen to some of the things that have happened since the last time we were on air.
Back to work! Back to work!
It's not every day you see workers of the federal government protesting the federal government.
We don't get what we want, one way or the other. I am proud to shut down the government for border security.
Yale University is now the first school to officially rescind the admission of a student linked to the college admission scandal. Prosecutors have arrested 50 people, including 33 wealthy parents and celebrities. They're accused of carrying out a scheme to cheat on standardized tests and or bribe college coaches to gain admission to elite schools.
In Birmingham, Alabama, where this morning we found the results of a two-month investigation into the police shooting of a black man inside of an Alabama mall. Today, the Attorney General, Steve Marshall's office, ruled that the police officer was justified in shooting E.J. Bradford on Thanksgiving night.
On the 18th of March, Cabinet agreed to establish an inquiry into the Christchurch mosque's terror attack. Today, Cabinet agreed the inquiry will be a royal commission. While New Zealanders and Muslim communities around the world are both grieving and showing compassion for one another, they are also quite rightly asking questions on how this terror attack was able to happen here.
So all of that has happened since the last time we're together, in addition to so many other things that have been happening in community. And how do we keep it all straight? How do we keep it in depth? How do we look at all the nuance around it? And those are just the big stories that were dominating headlines. We haven't even talked about the stories that aren't in the headlines that should be from our respective communities. Having heard all of that, what are some of the things that are coming onto your minds, especially one of the most recent things in this college cheating scandal?
When I look at some of the data that has been shared with us now, either directly because of that scandal or, say, by other organizations that are questioning how this could have been going on, there are a couple things that come up in my mind. One is, you know, what are the typical stereotypes that mainstream media and community have about people of color and their capacity or ability to attend elite schools? And, you know, part of that comes with some stereotypes that people of color can only get in on athletic scholarships. And some of this cheating scandal like went to that in terms of the crew teams and other type of athletic scholarships that came in. And when I looked at some data, so the National Collegiate Athletic Association estimated that in the Ivy League schools, 65% of student athletes were white. So that really disproves the stereotype that, mm-hmm. you know, students of color only get in because of athletic scholarships. And according to the Harvard Crimson, more than 46% of the athletes at Harvard specifically come from families who make more than $250,000, which The Atlantic then referred to as the affirmative action for rich white people. I mean, those are data points that I think need to be very salient and known in the broader community that really dispel factually that our students going to elite colleges who are students of color are not relying on the same type of admission criteria that some of these other athletes are doing.
So we can use this moment to dispel all of those different myths that are coming in there. And this is a moment of vindication for a lot of folks. Don, working in higher ed right now, I mean, what are the things that are coming up for you and your students in regards to all the data that Luz just put forward?
Well, you know, at Metropolitan State University, we're on a total different level.
Right.
We're a Minsky school. We're a public institution. We don't even have sports on campus. At least the student body and social work program right now, we are really close to about 60-65% students of color. And when we break that down, our students tend to be more immigrant and refugee population. So Metro State is drawing from a very diverse background. Most kids are competing on their own merit. So when, you know, when this story broke, because often when we attend institutions like that, people immediately assume that we're fulfilling an affirmative action quota, that the only way we were admitted into an institution is that we're fulfilling that requirement, that we really didn't deserve to be there. And I think that those are the discussions that are happening in our community around this incident.
Nobody would question if you're a student of color attending Metro State. However, the question comes up often and regularly, not just at Ivy League schools. First few years I attended the University of Minnesota, there was these conversations that came into there. Oh, you must be here because you can't possibly be here because you deserve to be here. And then we find out that a whole lot of folks used a whole lot of money and influence to get folks who weren't even qualified to attend the university into the university, thus vindicating a whole lot of folks of color who have been saying the same thing for a long time and not having folks believe them or having to fight to make that point.
When I was in law school, I went to University of Iowa Law School. I'll never forget. It was the first day there. And our graduating class was pretty large. It was close to 300. I think we were at 275, thereabout. The first day of orientation, and there were probably six Latinos in my class, so not a big class. This white guy comes over to a Latino, a new student, and taps him on the shoulder. Now, they had never met, and said, "Because you got in, my best friend did not get in."
Wow.
And he says, "I will make your life miserable for the next 3 years. If I can help it, you are not graduating law school."
He actually threatened?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And we reported it, you know, and it didn't go very far. Of course, the guy recants and says, "Well, I didn't quite say it that way, and I didn't really threaten him." And, you know, the excuses begin. But when I read stories like this, I think about the lived experiences that I've had and other friends have had, family members, that speak directly to, you know, this entitlement and privilege that some folks feel they have to get into these institutions.
I'm trying to put myself in the headspace of the student who's working three campus jobs, has maybe a couple of scholarships that they have to work hard to renew in order to get certain grades, et cetera. And they see this happen and they're like, "Why am I even bothering?"
I thought this was something that people knew was happening.
Well, I think we were aware that, I mean, we all kind of knew that if my grandfather donated $20 million to an institution and the library is named after Grandpa, there's a good bet I'm getting into that institution. So we knew those kind of things were happening. What this, I think, Hilly pointed out is that these weren't folks who had donated $20 million to have a building built. They were just paying people off, what were they saying, like $500,000, and altering their SAT and their ACT scores get them in. I mean, that's outright cheating.
And also making up complete lies about medical conditions. So I think about all the students who have medical disabilities, right? Mm-hmm. And students who need extra time on exams and accommodations to allow them to reach their potential in terms of test taking. And from the investigation, there were quite a number of students who got in basically based on false medical information and data that they needed these extra accommodations. What level of low can you go where you are fabricating a medical condition to give you an uneven chance to get in? And what you're then excluding is folks who actually have those medical conditions.
You know, I got to complicate this a little bit, because if you step back a little bit, and Lee, your question made something rise up for me a little bit, because there is a moment about this. It's like, finally, somebody's paying attention and holding some folks accountable for stuff that in community, we had this assumption that this was going on, and we had the experience and the stories of things like this going on as well. But then I go back and I say, all right, so I'm from a community where a whole lot of folks have moved, have done everything they could to try to get their kid into a school that doesn't marginalize them and isolate them with no resources whatsoever. And folks in my community have gone to jail for ridiculous amounts of time just for trying to get their kid into a good school. So,
and not by paying anybody off, but maybe by just listing a different address.
Listing a different address or actually moving and just having moved after a particular deadline and yet still getting criminal, you know, issues. So for me, this not only exposes a double standard that finally is getting some light shed on the other side of that standard, but then there's a double standard in the fact that these folks aren't the only ones doing this. And these folks, at worst, are going to have some fines. You know, some folks are floating around jail time, but I don't buy that that's actually going to happen.
No.
And so there's going to be some fines paid, and there's going to be some folks who don't get to go to that particular college. Meanwhile, folks in my community just try to get their kids into an elementary school without bribing and doing all these other criminal acts are sitting in jail. So we still, even in the midst of this, have a layer of double standard in there that we're forced to contend with and swallow.
You know, the other aspect I would add to this is some people might say or might reach the faulty conclusion that over time, this was necessary because there's too many admissions going to students of color. And yet that's wrong. There's an analysis that the New York Times did analyzing the freshman enrollment classes at the top colleges around the country. And it found that through this research that the share of black students at elite schools has been virtually unchanged since the 1980s. So we're talking almost 40 years. Mm-hmm. And that the rate of Hispanic students attending elite schools has not matched the rate of the Hispanic population. So, you know, this also disproves that there are too many students of color getting into elite schools. So there's not enough white students. So let's move aside and, you know, conjure up some other ways to get more of these students in.
And not just that, but I think, you know, the other thing that has kind of fallen to the wayside was this other concerted effort to do away with affirmative action by conquer and divide. So I believe Harvard was involved with this one, where this effort, again, to attack affirmative action was looking at it from the perspective of Asians were not being admitted at the rate that they should be admitted,
right,
because spots were going to other communities of color, particularly African Americans. So, you know, this concerted effort that's attacking affirmative action was taking that angle until this thing blew up. And in our discussions, it puts all that into context on how unfair the system has always been when it comes to folks from the dominant culture and people who have money. And, you know, efforts to allow us, Native Americans, African Americans, and other communities of color in the United States, just to have some access to some of these valuable resources is always constantly under attack. With this breaking of that story, it was like, you know, we knew that happens. We always knew it happens. And now we feel vindicated.
Lee, you work in a space of gathering stories and gathering the work of folks. One of the things, works of folks in community. One of the things that's coming up clear for me here is that there's stories of a whole lot of folks of color who've done a lot of work to get into these universities, to get into this space, and their stories have been pushed out for a long time. What are some of the stories that you're getting as you go and you talk to people and they start to bring this up?
So I don't want to seem like a downer, but I know,
back,
and
Kelly.
I know you're going to, I know.
Hey, our listeners rely on your perspective,
on you.
So they're counting on you. Don't let them down, Hilly.
Honestly, on this issue, I'm just like, whatever, what's the big deal? Everybody knows it's happening. You know, who in our community wouldn't believe that we have to work twice as hard to get to these places, right? And so it's so ridiculous in my head that this is like a big story and now they're trying to pin it on, you know, people of color getting in. I'm just like, we all knew it. We know that's the way things are and we're just going to keep going.
So, Hali, just a quick question. What would be an outcome that you'd be like, okay, this is moving the conversation forward, this is justice, or this is a sign of progress? What would you like to see happen out of this story?
I guess it's like, it's that's nice that they're finally recognizing it, but this has been happening for so long, and it's probably going to just keep happening. And, you know, I have bigger fish to fry. There are bigger things that I felt like we should be concerned about than this story about celebrities.
Although I want to say that a part of this that is, I think, a relief for some folks, whether in communities of color or not, is the issue of accountability and the issue of the false sense of meritocracy. Our nation is built on a premise of meritocracy. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. If you put the time in and the effort in, you will succeed.
Mm-hmm.
The issue of meritocracy has been a lie as it pertains to an entire subset of Americans, which are Americans that have been marginalized by the system, systemic barriers. And I would say that those are then individuals of color and individuals from indigenous communities as well. So from a standpoint of accountability, I think there is a real relief there, so to speak, at least a glimmer of hope. We'll see how it goes through the justice system. The other part of it is that there was a class action lawsuit, $5 million class action lawsuit filed against the 8 top colleges. The schools should be accountable, too. There needs to be some systemic changes that will protect the admissions process and safeguard it from these wrongdoings, right? And so that's the other part of this that I think needs to be called out. And as citizens of this country, as residents of this country, we need to continue to push that.
One of the things that we can do is press a reset button on how we think about and conceive admissions in the first place, to your point. Ivy League admissions in many places are, you know, when you think about how those are calculated, you have several different categories that are going to add to your admission space. And the categories are different depending on different Ivy League schools. Some of those are going to come from sports, but those sports are couched in sports that are where that make that category that you get points for predominantly white. You have the legacy question, which is in the mix, right? If we're going to have a conversation about affirmative action, then we need to have a conversation about legacy. There are points for genius points. There are all these different things that add to them. And being a person of color is just one. When you put that pie chart together, the vast majority of the populations that receive the points in those different areas are folk who come from dominant culture. So those are some questions that this is actually raising for me that I think if there's a glimmer, there's some questioning of that going on. But all of this brings us right back in front and center to an opportunity to have some wind behind the sails of dispelling certain stereotypes. And so one of those stereotypes is if you were a person who thought that to Luz's data that she brought in there, that people of color were pushing out white students from college admissions, or that stereotype dispelled.
And also, I mean, I think I don't know if we've underlined this enough, but that the people who actually really benefit from affirmative action are white women.
Yeah. So the myth that affirmative action is a leg up and an unfair advancement to people of color, the data proves, dispelled. What else can we go and add to this list?
So, I mean, the Civil Rights Act and the movement largely benefited and continues to benefit white women.
Mm-hmm.
We can spend an entire segment on that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the other myths I might want to throw into that space is who are the students that are coming in? And it's the same in our workplace discussion, right? This idea that you're an affirmative action hire, that you did not get there on your own merit. Some of the stories that I've actually started to see come out, not necessarily in dominant cultural media spaces, but a lot more attention has been to the experience of people of color in colleges. They're working. They're fighting hard to keep what little scholarship pieces are there. We haven't had a conversation about poor white students, mm-hmm. right? Where poor white students are being disadvantaged by the same practice of if you've got money to play, then you can pay and go. So there's those pieces in there. And there's a very interesting feel to this where white students are being told or being fed this idea, poor white students in particular, that student of color is the reason that you're not getting in after all the work you've put in. That smells a whole lot like Bacon's Rebellion, where poor whites and, mm-hmm. and slaves and black slaves were bound together to throw off this aristocratic process that was putting them down. And in order to break that up, they pitted one against the other. And so, you know, there's a lot of information you can get out of that in the book, How the Irish Became Black. It's a wonderful book. But that talks about Bacon's Rebellion space.
The History of White People does that as well.
Yes,
Dr. Nell Irvin Painter does that in her book.
So this really to me, opens up a good window to have some wind in the sails to break down some of these myths about what's really happening in college admissions and what the students who are really getting in really look like, feel like, sound like.
But, you know, not just college admissions.
Right.
This same dynamic has been happening across the board in our country in terms of limiting our accesses to other valuable resources beyond just education, but housing, dispelling that myth of pulling up your boots and going the whole nine yards. You know, we've talked about that before. It never made sense to me because a first down is 10 yards. Why was only nine? You're 1 yard short, right? But, you know, I mean, I hated that when people would throw that in my face under the guise that if you work hard, you should be able to succeed.
Right.
And then I don't have enough time to explain to them all the barriers that were put in place that didn't allow my father to access the GI Bill after being fighting in World War II. Or, you know, and the stories just go on and on. We've talked about those topics before and all of our other counter stories. But, you know, all these things tie together. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so this incident was just another aha moment where as communities of color and as Native Americans, we were able to sit back and say, see, we told you so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It also goes back to, it makes me think about Brown versus Board of Education, the desegregation of schools at the time, which was supposed to be this really great advance. Oh, we're going to desegregate schools. Education will be equal for everyone. And look how that played out. I mean, what you ended up having was, you know, a loss of great educators of Black culture within Black communities being taken into other schools. And then suddenly the Black students are getting teachers that don't recognize who they are and what they deal with on a daily basis and view them as other. And so they're not giving them the quality education that they could be getting.
Well, and the school resources, too. The districts that benefit most, that have the most resources per student allocation, ends up being whiter neighborhoods, whiter schools, where the more experienced teachers then flock to them. And so it perpetuates the systemic barriers and the disadvantage that comes to low-income communities or communities of color and indigenous communities.
But this speaks to our problem in this conversation in that all of the things that you just said have volumes of backstory and nuance that get to the statement that you just made that I find and encounter often folks don't have all of that backstory, right? So even if I get to the school funding thing, right? If you go to the state of Minnesota and you look at per pupil, just on the per pupil, you might get the sense that, oh, no. Students of color and impoverished students receive more money per pupil from the state for their school district. But that then brings you to the referendum questions. I can raise more money in more affluent property tax spaces to add and counter that a little bit. So if I'm a school district that only receives per pupil and not as much referendum funding, if I live in a more affluent area with a higher tax base and I pass a smaller referendum, which is easier politically to pass, I still end up with more money because of the values that are there. And so you end up with deep imbalance just on the funding piece alone, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think one of the things that we need to put onto the table is to say we've just raised a whole lot of issues with a whole lot of nuance and backstories. And I think in part two, one of the things that we need to do is start to talk about how we start to unpack and get below the surface on those things.
You're listening to Counter Stories on Minnesota Public Radio News. I'm Marianne Combs, joined by my co-hosts here. We're going to get back to our topic at hand in just a moment. But first, it's time for an update of news headlines. And we're back. You're listening to Counter Stories on Minnesota Public Radio News. And we're talking this hour about the recent college scandal and really more broadly writ inequities in education at large. And Anthony, you were talking about how do we get behind and underneath some of these issues to talk more deeply about the causes and the ramifications.
So if you are hearing Counter Stories for the first time, one of the things that we often do is we surface conversations that in a broad sense, but that have so many layers underneath that are being talked about in community. And so one of the things that we should probably do is to start pointing out what are some of the ways that we get to these different layers? Because this we talk about these things all the time, and sometimes we package them all together. And in the words of one of my favorite organizational thinkers, Ron Heifetz, you know, these are adaptive issues. That means that there's a bunch of different issues bundled all together and you got to deal with all of them at the same time. It's like unwinding a really, really tight knot. So what are some of the ways that we can get under the layers of what are happening here, not just through the vehicle of this college cheating scandal space, but really the many different stereotypes and underlying issues that we're talking about here? How do we start pulling this knot apart?
You know, for me, it's really having an understanding and a commitment that learning about equity, because this is what we're really talking about, race equity, but just equity in general, is a never-ending experience and commitment. A commitment to learn and to be a lifelong learner in that space will get you then the experience that you need and help guide you to the growth that we are all hoping to have, right? So it's not a one and done. And that there are plenty of resources online, whether through social media or you can receive them through your emails, that will help you get there, and books. And we can discuss all of this right now and just kind of, you know, open it up for that. But that's, for me, is, you know, doing this work for over 30 years and still feeling that I am nowhere near where I need to be in terms of my growth. You know, by analogy, if you're a professional as a lawyer or a doctor or a business, you know, financial sector, you always have to continue to read and educate yourself, or a teacher. The same holds true for this, for equity and for inclusion, and being able to constantly challenge yourself within and ask yourself, what are my biases? What are my understandings? And how do I receive the information differently, perhaps, that I'm reading that will allow me to go past those?
So, you know, I have a lot of folks who do a lot of really good reading and study and still perpetuate and do some of these same patterns over and over again, but feel like their work is done because they've done the reading space. Mm. So, you know, it's got you coming into my mind right now, because you are a person who collects the stories of folks whose stories don't get told often, to try to bring that equation in there. So after I've done the study, how do I start to get to those rich stories that the subconscious doesn't change unless there's some real deep pattern work over time to the point you just made, Luz? But then also those deep emotional reactions and connections that you make with other people. Where do I begin? Where do I begin if I'm a person who's never heard anything separate than the experiences of where I grew up, and it doesn't include any of these below the line experiences that we've put forward? It's a hard jump off space to do in a real way.
So let me give an example. All right. So often you hear me talk about the invisibility of Native Americans.
Yeah.
Okay. And yet this is our land. This is where we're from. I mean, yeah, my ancestors were here. Okay. We are it. So, yeah, I've said before that one of the classes I teach is comparative racial and ethnic analysis. And so I would ask the students one simple question. How many reservations are there in the state of Minnesota? And in the 3 years I was in that classroom, I have not had one correct answer. And I would use that just as a vehicle to talk about how, through the lack of our educational system, which tends to gloss over what really happened in this country, which then allows people to have misinformation and or no information about what really happened, so that someone who looks at me and says that my grandparents immigrated over here and pulled up their boots and worked really hard and went the whole nine yards and were successful, how come you and your people can't do that? To me, that is the crux of, I think, what you're trying to get at. You know, when we talk in terms of equity, when we talk in terms of the social construct of race, when we talk in terms of what systemic racism is, when we talk in terms of putting all these things together, to me, just that simple question, how many reservations are in Minnesota, is just the tip of that iceberg. So when often those of us who work in this field, we understand all those dynamics, but others who aren't at that same level still can hear our conversations and still walk away unconvinced because they don't have that background.
As somebody who is a white cis female and has come from a place of complete racial ignorance to slightly less complete racial ignorance, I would say one of the things I have learned in the process is do your own homework. Don't ask people of color to do the work for you. Don't go up to them and say, so why should I care about this? That I have to go and educate myself and educate other white people. Like, we should educate ourselves together so that we don't come up and ask for people to do the labor for us. And that education is so extensive. So, as you were saying earlier, Luz, it's unending. There is no, oh, now I'm educated. Mm-hmm. It's just a constant sort of pulling back the veil and pulling back another layer and another layer. But yeah, to your point, you have so much history that's just welling up there. You can't answer it in any simple question. It's like, how do I even begin to respond to one of those questions? So
I see that every time we get into a conversation and one of our Native brothers and sisters is going to respond to something, they have to spend a whole lot of time just given all the historical nuance to it and all those pieces because they haven't learned it. I mean, we still are walking around thinking Wall Street is just an innocuous commerce center. Wall Street's called Wall Street because it was the wall where slaves were bought and sold in New York at a time after its beginning where it was illegal to own slaves, but you could still lease them. Or to talk about the below-the-line history around Central Park. Central Park was Seneca Village. It was a village of black folks who was removed to put that park there in the center because nobody wanted to look at this community that was actually starting to amass resource. Any place where people of color have started to amass resource in an agency and autonomy across the United States have been disrupted in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that comes to me, to my mind, is we need to look at some more people's history approaches or look at the media of the people who are actually living those perspectives, because you start to get, you'll see more folks pulling apart these stereotypes, right? You can't look at the spokesman recorder in Minnesota and continue to see, to have a stereotype in your mind of a community that's not together, that's in shambles and all those kinds of things. You can look at your own data for that. There's this assumption that the absent father is a stereotype in the black community. That's not true. The vast majority of black folks have two parents in their lives, right? If you're going to get a question of whether or not we're married, well, that's the same statistics as anybody, any other community. So there's a whole lot of misinfo that's out there that you need to go to the sources of the folks who actually live in it. You know,
well, and why that misinformation exists and who created a narrative around that. If you think about the Moynihan Report, and that's really what started the whole, you know, stereotype of black women on public assistance and who's on public assistance. And the reality of it is it's never been the majority of women of color. It's been the majority of white women. But the other part of that, in terms of the absent father and the narrative that came out of the Moynihan Report as well. And the purpose, of course, was to demonize a certain aspect of our community, right? Black families.
Mm-hmm.
And to continue to subjugate their economic interests, but also their political small p agency and will in our community to, you know, create a narrative that was negative so that they continue to be looked at in a way that is less than favorable by the rest of our society.
And there's the political implications there. What you just said flies in the face of folks who carry an assumption that the political party that's concerned about folks of color are the Democrats and the political party that's not are the Republicans. But when you go back and you look just in our last 25 years, some of the most hurtful, inequitable policies have been put forward by liberals. And so there's a critique of both liberal identities and conservative identities by people of color. And yet it gets tossed around as a football as if, to your point, Donna, this is divide and conquer. So one of the things that I would offer is make sure that when you go back and you excoriate and you dive deep, that you're also looking at and questioning the experiences of those you assume to be for people of color, because folks, communities of color have healthy critiques of those same folks.
I think a really good line to keep in mind is one that journalists are supposed to keep in mind at all times is follow the money.
That's right. Yeah.
And oftentimes that leads to why the system is set up the way it is, because it's taking advantage of certain communities while profiting others.
Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, yep. does a really good job of calling out that issue in particular as it pertains to the criminal justice issue, or criminal justice system, I should say. But also, Anthony, to your latest point, it also calls out why, you know, and who implemented these public policies. The three strikes and you're out, those were, you know, all by liberal leaders. And yet, you know, they were disproportionately implemented against black men.
Another example of this ideology and policy, because I remember the whole discussion around, okay, in the area of child welfare and child support, the category of men who were notorious not paying child support weren't low-income fathers, black fathers, native fathers, were white professional men, doctors, lawyers, folks of means, folks who had the money to pay child support but were so pissed off with their ex-wife, they didn't want to have anything to do with it. They passed legislation to withhold licenses. Mm-hmm. The aim of that was to be able to yank a lawyer's license or their hurt their practice. How was that policy implemented? The only licenses that were ever taken were the driver's licenses of low-income fathers who had, once they had lost their license to drive, had no means to get to work to support their families. So even when policies were created around that whole discussion, they are not implemented.
Or have the best of intention,
yes.
but we don't do the follow-up and legwork to look at how they will affect everybody down the line.
Going back to what we were saying about, is it the desegregation of schools and affirmative action? It comes across as looking like, hey, we're doing this great thing for people of color. And then suddenly, somehow the rug's pulled out from underneath you and you look at the situation and actually, oh, it's been taken advantage so it doesn't benefit people of color. And actually, it's taking the profit away from the resources away from those communities. I've got a question for you guys, and this is just because I'm currently reading Robin DiAngelo's White Fragility book, and I recently had the opportunity to see her speak. And of course, she makes it really clear that, you know, she's just saying things that people of color have been saying for decades, and her work is built upon their shoulders. But for some reason, you know, because it's a white person saying it, she's getting a lot more attention and credibility than other people have been in the past.
No kidding.
Yeah. But she's naming things outright in a way that I have not seen named in public discourse in a way that's really powerful. She's saying, yes, racism, yes, colorism, and yes, white people, their relationship to black people is far more complex and complicated and otherized than other people of color. We have to name it. We have to look at it intently and what the consequences are of that. The fact that this is, that she's getting the response she's getting, she's going on speaker tours and she's sold out. People are coming in droves to hear her speak. Her book is, you know, very popular. Do you think like something's getting through that people are starting to recognize race in a way and colorism in a way that they haven't before?
You know, there's a couple of problematic pieces with your question. One, you're asking it to a group of folks of color who we've already, as we've already talked about, have been living the day to day in and day out, getting a sense that your question is our read on whether or not dominant culture it's getting through.
Yeah.
And so that would mean that we'd have to give an assessment for dominant cultural space as folks of color who are continually having to be put out and marginalized. That seems like a question for white folks.
But on the other hand, I would also say that white people, you know, white people better than white people know themselves.
So here's the thing, you know,
that's deep.
Someone's going to write a book about this. It's going to be called The Help.
That's exactly the book that was in my mind.
Yeah.
You know, when you think about your question, Marianne, and YWCA Minneapolis, we did bring Robin DiAngelo as part of its Time to Act speaker series. It's no different than when Tim Wise was hitting the circuit.
Come on.
So Tim Wise is a white man who has for the last dozen plus years, if not maybe two decades, has done the circuit talking about racism and talking about privilege and all these other areas that you would think, right?
Julie Landsman, and, Peggy McIntosh.
Yeah, and Peggy McIntosh. There is something there that allows your own to call your stuff out. Put your dirty laundry out. Air it out, right? And I think that's, Robin says that repeatedly in her book. And I think that is what is being seen and validated now. The issue of white fragility, she coined that term about 10 years ago or so. And we see white fragility in play every day as people of color and indigenous people. And it repeats a pattern that our own lived experiences and our own voices as people of color, indigenous people, don't have the same validation and weight that the voice coming from a white, you know, community and a white professional does have, which just further perpetuates our experience on race in our country, right? Where we continue to be in this false narrative of, well, we can make headway on race and we can make progress on race, but only if it comes through a certain lens. Because if it comes through a lens from communities of color, indigenous people, there is not enough weight or credibility given to those voices. But it's got to come through a voice that we trust, quote unquote, someone who looks like us or sounds like us, and then there'll be more credibility to it. And that's a real sad statement, and that it took and it continues to take someone from the white community to persuade white people to listen and to wake up.
But we know this. Everybody
we know this, but this. But does the white community know that? That's my point.
We know it. So what is the thing that we need to do to change it, really, is that we need to celebrate the people in our community when they are the ones who are going around doing these things. We need to celebrate them so that when somebody else, because we know the white people aren't listening, when somebody else brings it to the white people, when another white person brings it to the white people, you know?
Okay. Can I just go back to, so yes, on the one hand, people of color have been saying this forever and they're not being taken seriously. Now a white woman stands up and somebody's like, oh my gosh, wow, she's brilliant. On the other hand, we also have the idea that people of color shouldn't have to do all the emotional labor and the work on behalf of white people, that white people need to do their own work and learn from each other and study and talk about this, and it shouldn't be the responsibility.
Yeah, but what's the likelihood of that?
You got me swimming right here, right? Because you got Elder Mahmoud El-Khati in my head right now, who says you can spend a whole lot of energy trying to change dominant culture, or you can build your own institutions and celebrate yourself.
Exactly. Yes. Yes.
And so, I mean, that resonates.
And hope history doesn't repeat itself.
Well, right.
Yeah.
All right? Because the history of this country is when we do put those building blocks in place, efforts eventually will come along either subvertly or overtly, and those efforts are subjugate and everything is blown apart.
I'll give you a perfect example. In the recent 3 years, many folks have been passing around education circles this storybook, Ruth and the Green Book, which is bringing an elementary school book to teach folks about what the Green Book was. All this history about Willie Green and all these things come out. And it leads up to, oh, here's finally a mass media blockbuster that's going to be put forward. And the black folks were secondary in the entire story, and we glorify the white character in there. It's completely made up to the chagrin of the family itself, and don't teach any real history about the Green Book in itself. So that's a perfect example right now of history repeating itself in that way.
Won an
and
Oscar.
It wins an Oscar.
You know, it was like, well, we had that. We had Dances with Wolves.
Right.
Right? Same thing. Same buildup, same white savior.
But Klee, to your point, I mean, if those are big national pieces, but when we talk about more closer to home institutions, right, local spaces celebrating and upholding and uplifting folks who are—
Like Rondo Neighborhood?
Rondo Neighborhood, but I'm talking about more specifically the folks who are doing amazing work in those communities. We give a lot more space to all these things that, one, aren't working, and two, don't have anything to do with us, and a lot less space and energy behind uplifting the folks who are really doing some really awesome work on the ground. Is that kind of what you're getting to?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm getting to.
So we're talking about, like, someone in the Native American community like Winona LaDuke, has been leading this environmental justice thing for the past 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and while people are familiar with what she does, not to the recognition she really needs, or, you know, and efforts by many others in the Native American community to save this planet.
And we have lots of things
in place. Now it's really, these are big stories. Like, I just feel like, you know, for myself anyways, I always knew people of color were doing these great things.
You're going to the story, the folks, the fact that people have of color have been doing amazing things in their community the whole time.
Right. And so right now there are these big stories and they're supposed to make, I mean, you know, you're hearing about specific people doing these things. And it's a big story in the mainstream media because it's like, white people didn't expect a Native American person to be fighting for that right, you know? And so they're all of a sudden, they're held up special, you know?
Mm. So I guess one good learning piece there is, and I'm thinking about when I look at a story and what should be a story, we tend to move to the things that are going to have the biggest reactionary space. But if we really want to balance and then grow our consciousness, we need to be looking for the stories that aren't sexy to dominant cultural space. And therein, we'll start to find the everyday amazing folks who are doing the work on the ground.
Yes, you can read my mind.
I love everything about that.
The thing that popped in my mind while this discussion was happening is the film we saw, what was it, 2 years ago? James Baldwin?
I'm not your Negro.
Oh, yeah.
What was, you know, that was so powerful coming from the black community, coming from a renowned author, James Baldwin, with the same message, right? But not getting the same play. I've used Tim Weiss's stuff in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And now that Robin's along, you know, now we have a female doing the same thing. And so we'll use Robin's stuff in the classroom. I was wondering how Tim was feeling because she kind of knocked him off his pedestal there for a while. And that's fine, you know, and from my perspective, anything that helps the dominant culture move that needle, right? I'm not going to sit back and get mad, you know, because we've been saying it our entire lives. But anything that helps move that needle, I'm fine with. You know, I don't care who gets the credit as long as that needle is moving.
Yeah, I think what you're getting to is it's a both and, right? It's a both and situation where having the voices of a Robin DiAngelo or a Tim Wise is perfectly fine, and we don't have a qualm about that, but not to the exclusion of then voices coming from lived experiences.
Exactly.
When you talked about James Baldwin, the first thing that popped in my mind in addition was watching the film If Beale Street Could Talk.
Mm. Yeah.
And, you know, if you haven't seen it, there's a great James Baldwin quote at the beginning of it. But what it looks to is just the systemic injustices, again, of the criminal justice system. And it's a look back to, you know, a particular example in the 70s. But those are the issues that are playing themselves out today.
Yes.
In today's real life examples that as you continue as a listener, as a consumer, if you will, of this content, that content will come to you, whether it's in films, in books, in poetry, on social media, in conversation, in friendships and relationships. We talked about relationships earlier. You know, there's a great exercise that we as YWCA Minneapolis promote, which is take an inventory of who your friends are, what your network looks like, your network within the professional setting, your business setting, and then your friendship, your personal network. And if it looks pretty much just like you and is not encompassing of our demographics in terms of our cities, then you've got a lot of work to do, right? Well, you've got some work to do to fix that.
Like you were talking about earlier, Don, there was the woman who got more time because she was trying to register her child into another school district.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it kind of came all right back around.
And right back around is where we often end up because there's so much. But one thing is clear with all of this that we've talked about so far, we're back. From the college scandal to the dispelling of everyday stereotypes, a marathon, not a sprint, moving the needle bit by bit, telling the stories of everyday brilliance. One thing is clear. This is Counter Stories. I'm Anthony Galloway.
Luz Maria Frias,
Don Eubanks,
Lily,
and Marianne Combs.